Welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, November 28th, 2022. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here's our first story. Protesters calls for Xi to step down. Stringent anti-COVID measures in China led to confrontation. This is by Dake Kang from the Associated Press out of Shanghai. Protesters, angered by strict antivirus measures, called for China's powerful leader to resign, an unprecedented rebuke as authorities in at least eight cities struggled to suppress demonstrations Sunday that represent a rare direct challenge to the ruling Communist Party. Police using pepper spray drove away demonstrators in Shanghai who called for Xi Jinping to step down and an end to one-party rule. But hours later, people rallied again in the same spot. Police again broke up the demonstration, and reporters saw protesters under arrest being driven away in a bus. The protests, which began Friday and have spread to cities including the capital, Beijing, and dozens of university campuses, are the most widespread show of opposition to the ruling party in decades. In a video of the protest in Shanghai, verified by the Associated Press, chants against Xi, the most powerful leader since at least the 1980s, and the Chinese Communist Party sounded loud and clear. Xi Jinping, step down. CCP, step down. 3 years after the virus emerged, China is the only major country still trying to stop transmission of COVID-19. Its zero-COVID strategy has suspended access to neighborhoods for weeks at a time. Some cities carry out daily virus tests on millions of residents. That has kept China's infection numbers lower than those of the United States and other major countries. But public acceptance has worn thin. People who are quarantined at home in some areas say they lack food and medicine. The ruling party faced public anger following the deaths of two children whose parents said antivirus controls hampered efforts to get medical help. The current protests erupted after a fire broke out Thursday and killed at least 10 people in an apartment building in the city of Urumqi in the northwest, where some have been locked in their homes for 4 months. That prompted an outpouring of angry questions online about whether firefighters or people trying to escape were blocked by locked doors or other restrictions. About 300 demonstrators gathered late Saturday in Shanghai, most of whose 25 million people were confined to their homes for almost 2 months starting in late March. On a street named for Urumqi, one group of protesters brought candles, flowers, and signs honoring those who died in the blaze. Another group, according to a protester who insisted on anonymity, was more active, shouting slogans and singing the national anthem. That protester and another, who gave only his family name, Zhao, confirmed the chants against Xi, who awarded himself a third 5-year term as leader of the ruling party, and who some expect to try to stay in power for life. Like others who spoke to the AP, the protesters didn't want to be identified due to fear of arrest or retaliation. The atmosphere of the protest encouraged people to speak about topics considered taboo, including the 1989 crackdown on the Tiananmen Square pro-democracy protests, the protester who insisted on anonymity said. Some called for an official apology for the deaths in the fire in Urumqi in the Xinjiang region. One member of Xinjiang's Uyghur ethnic group, which has been the target of a security crackdown that includes mass detentions, shared his experiences of discrimination and police violence. Everyone thinks that Chinese people are afraid to come out and protest, that they don't have any courage, said the protester, adding it was his first time demonstrating. Actually, in my heart, I also thought this way, but then when I went there, I found that the environment was such that everyone was very brave. The scene turned violent early Sunday. Hundreds of police broke up the more active group before they came for the second, as they tried to move people off the main street. The protester said that he saw people being taken away, forced by police into vans, but could not identify them. Zhao said one of his friends was beaten by police and two were pepper sprayed. He lost his shoes and left barefoot. He said protesters yelled slogans, including one that has become a rallying cry. We do not want PCR tests, but want freedom. On Sunday afternoon, crowds returned to the same spot and again railed against PCR tests. People stood and filmed as police shoved people. Officers in surgical masks and yellow safety vests told a crowd of about 300 spectators to leave, but appeared to be trying to avoid a confrontation. There was no sign of shields or other riot gear. In Beijing, a group of about 200 people gathered in a park on the capital's east side and held up blank sheets of paper, a symbol of defiance against the ruling party's pervasive censorship. "The lockdown policy is so strict," said a protester, who would only give his surname Li. "You cannot compare it to any other country. We have to find a way out." Postings on social media said there were also demonstrations at 50 universities. About 2,000 students at Xi's alma mater, Tsinghua University in Beijing, gathered to demand an easing of antivirus controls, according to social media posts. The protesters left after the university's deputy Communist Party secretary promised to hold a school-wide discussion. Videos on social media that said they were filmed in Nanjing in the east, Guangzhou in the south, and at least six other cities showed protesters tussling with police in white protective suits or dismantling barricades used to seal off neighborhoods. The Associated Press could not verify that all of these protests took place or where. This story, setting up shop. Santa's house gets new digs on Pierce Street. This is by Earl Horlick out of Sioux City. Just in time for the holidays, the Gifted Boutique, 422 Pierce Street, will have a new second-floor tenant with a very familiar face. That's right, Kris Kringle and his missus have taken over the upper level of Unity Point Health, St. Luke's downtown gift shop, providing Santa's house with approximately 4,000 square feet of space. "Santa Claus has a nice home away from home this year," Unity Point Volunteer Services Manager Mary O'Brien said, showing off the big man's new digs. "Though 4,000 square feet will fill up quickly when there are a lot of families here at one time." O'Brien made that discovery during a sneak preview of Santa's house, which occurred after November 21st downtown for the holidays lighted parade. "We hit a few snags that first night," she said. "Things should be fine when we officially open for the season. This will occur soon enough. Santa's house will be open from 6 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, and 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, between December 6th and December 18th. Started as a fundraising event by St. Luke's Auxiliary 33 years ago, Santa's house has become an annual tradition for at least two generations of Siouxland residents. We've had moms and dads who've come to Santa's house when they were kids," O'Brien said. "They've kept happy memories of Santa's house after all those years. There's plenty of things to see, do, and remember at Santa's house. While admission to Santa's house is free, a small fee will be charged if kids want to make a craft or munch on any of Mrs. Claus's homemade cookies. Similarly, games like the ever-popular Pin the Nose on the Reindeer requires a small charge, but O'Brien said the cost remains minimal. Even in our Santa's gift shop section, all gifts are $10 or below," she said. "A chat with Santa Claus is free. A photo with the North Pole native can be purchased for as little as $3. Which isn't bad, since Santa's house operates with an all-volunteer staff, while all of its proceeds benefit the many projects of Unity Point Health, St. Luke's partners. Since 1989, Santa's house has raised more than $264,000 to benefit Siouxland by providing funding for such programs as Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, and its behavioral and mental health services. Santa's house can bring as many as 5,000 visitors on any given holiday season," O'Brien said. "That's a lot of happy faces who come through our doors every year." The next article, City Gets Grant for Big Sioux River Campground, by Dolly Butts. This is out of Sioux City. The city of Sioux City has been awarded more than $104,000 in grant funding from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to develop a campground on the north side of the Sioux City Railroad Museum, adjacent to the Big Sioux River. The City Council will be asked Monday to approve a resolution authorizing the Parks and Recreation Department to accept a Resource Enhancement and Protection Fund grant in the amount of $104,998 for the Big Sioux River Campground Development Project. According to city documents, the grant funding will support the purchase of 16.14 acres of land at the base of the first bluffs of Lost Hills, between Sioux River Road and the Big Sioux River. The RV campground will offer 79 motorhome and trailer campsites, with the potential to serve between 316 and 474 campers. The campsite pads will accommodate motorhomes, toy haulers, teardrop campers, camper vans, fifth wheel trailers, and pop-up campers. The Sioux City Railroad Museum will provide overnight tent camping on a 5-acre green space lying between the river bend and the historical railroad zone. Due to the awarded funding, the City of Sioux City and the Sioux City Railroad Museum will enter into a development agreement, the documents state. The city will be presented for consideration a capital improvement program fiscal year 2024 budget request in the amount of $320,000 to be allocated towards the remaining funding for the property acquisition. A 30-acre site nestled between the Les Hills and the Big Sioux River became home to the Sioux City Railroad Museum in 1995. Today, the museum features historic buildings and structures, as well as industrial archaeological sites, industrial heritage objects, and a railroad yard. The city also partnered with the Railroad Museum on the Big Sioux Highway 12 Trail Project, a 1.19-mile trail running along the Iowa side of the Big Sioux River. The trail traverses around the outskirts of the museum's property and runs along Highway 12 to the intersection at Military Road. The trail's loop configuration has terminal points at the intersection of Military Road and River Drive and the intersection of Military Road and Highway 12. The campground will create a destination for visitors, instill community pride in residents, and expand and enhance recreational opportunities to serve residents and tourists, according to the documents. The next article, out of Omaha, bird flu prompts slaughter of 1.8 million chickens in Dixon County. This is by Josh Funk, the Associated Press. Nebraska agricultural officials say another 1.8 million chickens must be killed after bird flu was found on a farm in the latest sign that the outbreak that has already prompted the slaughter of more than 50 million birds nationwide continues to spread. The Nebraska Department of Agriculture said Saturday that the state's 13th case of bird flu was found on an egg-laying farm in northeast Nebraska's Dixon County. Just like on other farms where bird flu has been found this year, all the chickens on the Nebraska farm will be killed to limit the spread of the disease. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says more than 52.3 million birds in 46 states, mostly chickens and turkeys on commercial farms, have been slaughtered as part of this year's outbreak. Nebraska is second only to Iowa's 15.5 million birds killed, with 6.8 million birds now affected at 13 farms. In most past bird flu outbreaks, the virus largely died off during the summer, but this year's version found a way to linger and started to make a resurgence this fall, with more than 6 million birds killed in September. The virus is primarily spread by wild birds as they migrate across the country. Wild birds can often carry the disease without showing symptoms. The virus spreads through droppings or the nasal discharge of an infected bird, which can contaminate dust and soil. Commercial farms have taken a number of steps to prevent the virus from infecting their flocks, including requiring workers to change clothes before entering barns and sanitizing trucks as they enter the farm. But the disease can be difficult to control. Zoos have also taken precautions and closed some exhibits to protect their birds. Officials say there is little risk to human health from the virus because human cases are extremely rare and the infected birds aren't allowed to enter the nation's food supply. Plus, any viruses will be killed by properly cooking poultry to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. But the bird flu outbreak has contributed to the rising prices of chicken and turkey, along with the soaring cost of feed and fuel. The next article, also from the Associated Press, is out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Colorado shooting victim wanted to save the family I found. A member of the U.S. Navy who was injured while helping prevent further harm during a shooting at a gay nightclub in Colorado last weekend said Sunday that he simply wanted to save the family that I found. Petty Officer Second Class Thomas James made his first public comments on the shooting in a statement issued through Centura Penrose Hospital in Colorado Springs, where James is recovering from undisclosed injuries suffered during the attack. Colorado Springs Police Chief Adrian Vasquez said that James was one of two men who helped to stop the shooter who walked into Club Q late on November 19th with multiple firearms, including a semi-automatic rifle, and killed five people. At least 17 others were injured when a drag queen's birthday celebration turned into a massacre. James reportedly pushed a rifle out of the shooter's reach while Army veteran Rich Fierro repeatedly struck the shooter with a handgun the shooter brought into the bar, officials have said. If I had my way, I would shield everyone I could from the nonsensical acts of hate in the world, but I am only one person, James said in a statement. Thankfully, we are a family, and family looks after one another. Patrons of Club Q have said the bar offered them a community where they felt celebrated, but that the shooting shook their sense of safety. The shooting suspect, Anderson Lee Aldrich, 22, was visibly injured during his initial court appearance on Wednesday. He was ordered held without bail. Formal charges have not been filed, and Aldrich has not spoken about the shooting. I want to support everyone who has known the pain and loss that have been all too common these past few years, James said. My thoughts are with those we lost on November 19th and those who are still recovering from their injuries. Colorado Governor Jared Polis, the first openly gay man elected governor in the United States, appeared on two Sunday morning TV shows saying he would support increasing licensing requirements for semi-automatic weapons, improving mental health services, and better use of red flag laws that allow courts to remove weapons from people having mental health crises and who may be a danger to themselves and others. He also urged the toning down of anti-LGBTQ political rhetoric. We know that when people are saying incendiary things, somebody who's not well-balanced can hear those things and think that what they're doing is heroic when it's actually a horrific crime that kills innocent people, Paulus said in NBC's Meet the Press. James ended the statement by urging young members of the LGBTQ community to be brave. Your family is out there. You are loved and valued, James said. So when you come out of the closet, come out swinging. Okay, in the Nation and World section of the paper, there is a picture with the caption, "Powerful landslide kills at least 7 in Italy." Search teams have recovered 7 dead, including a 3-week-old infant and a pair of young siblings, buried in mud and debris that hurtled down a mountainside and through a densely populated port city on the southern Italian resort island of Ischia, officials said Sunday. The Naples prefect confirmed that 5 people were missing and feared buried under the debris. The picture shows an aerial view of damaged houses Sunday on the island. That was from Salvatore Laporta out of the Associated Press. We also have an article entitled, "Ukraine Rushes to Restore Power. Russia strikes eastern southern areas and residents flee Kherson." This is from Sam Mednick and Jamie Keaton from the Associated Press out of Kherson, Ukraine. Russian forces struck eastern and southern Ukraine early Sunday as utility crews scrambled to restore power, water, and heating with the onset of snow and frigid temperatures, while civilians continued to leave the southern city of Kherson because of the devastation wreaked by recent attacks and their fears of more ahead. With persistent snowfall blanketing the capital of Kyiv on Sunday, analysts predicted that wintry weather, bringing with it frozen terrain and grueling fighting conditions, could have an increasing impact on the conflict that has raged since Russian forces invaded Ukraine more than 9 months ago. Both sides were already bogged down by heavy rain and muddy battlefield conditions, experts said. After a blistering series of Russian artillery strikes on infrastructure that started last month, workers were fanning out in around-the-clock deployments to restore key basic services, as many Ukrainians were forced to cope with only a few hours of electricity per day, if any. Ukrenergo, the state power grid operator, said Sunday that electricity producers are now supplying about 80% of demand, compared to 75% the previous day. The deprivations have revived jousting between Ukraine's president and Kyiv's mayor. Mayor Vitaly Klitschko on Sunday defended himself against allegations leveled by President Volodymyr Zelensky that too many Kyiv residents were still without power and that insufficient centers had been set up for them to stock up on food, water, battery power, and other essentials. Klitschko wrote on Telegram that hundreds of such centers are in operation, as well as hundreds of emergency generators, adding that, "I do not want, especially in the current situation, to enter into political battles. It's ridiculous." The Institute for the Study of War, a think tank that has been closely monitoring developments in Ukraine, said reporting from both sides indicated that heavy rain and mud have had an impact, along with wider freezing expected along the front lines in the coming days. This article is entitled Biden, Dems Push Ban on Assault Weapons. Weapons ban isn't happening soon in divided Congress. By Colleen Long, Mary Clara Jelinek, and Lindsay Whitehurst from the Associated Press, out of Washington. When President Joe Biden speaks about the scourge of gun violence, his go-to answer is to zero in on assault weapons. America has heard it hundreds of times, including last week after shootings in Colorado and Virginia. The president wants to sign into law a ban on high-powered guns that have the capacity to kill many people very quickly. The idea we still allow semi-automatic weapons to be purchased is sick, just sick, Biden said on Thanksgiving Day. I'm going to try to get rid of assault weapons. After the mass killing last Saturday at a gay nightclub in Colorado Springs, he said in a statement, "When will we decide we've had enough? We need to enact an assault weapons ban to get weapons of war off America's streets." When Biden and other lawmakers talk about assault weapons, they are using an inexact term to describe a group of high-powered guns or semi-automatic long rifles, like an AR-15, that can fire 30 rounds fast without reloading. By comparison, New York Police Department officers carry a handgun that shoots about half that much. A weapons ban is far off in a closely divided Congress, but Biden and the Democrats have become increasingly emboldened in pushing for stronger gun controls, and doing so with no clear electoral consequences. The Democratic-led House passed legislation in July to revive a 1990s-era ban on assault weapons, with Biden's vocal support. And the president pushed a ban nearly everywhere that he campaigned this year. Still in the midterm elections, Democrats kept control of the Senate, and Republicans were only able to claim the slimmest House majority in two decades. The tough talk follows passage in June of a landmark bipartisan bill on gun laws, and it reflects steady progress that gun control advocates have been making in recent years. More than half of voters want to see nationwide gun policy made more strict. According to AP VoteCast, an extensive survey of more than 94,000 voters nationwide conducted for the Associated Press by NORC, NORC, at the University of Chicago. About 3 in 10 want gun policy kept as is. Only 14% prefer looser gun laws. There are clear partisan divides. About 9 in 10 Democrats want stricter gun laws, compared with about 3 in 10 Republicans. About half of Republicans want get gun laws left as they are, and only one quarter want to see gun laws be made less strict. Once banned in the United States, the high-powered firearms are now the weapon of choice among young men responsible for many of the most devastating mass shootings. Congress allowed the restrictions first put in place in 1994 on the manufacture and sales of the weapons to expire a decade later, unable to muster the political support to counter the powerful gun lobby and reinstate the weapons ban. When he was governor of Florida, current Republican Senator Rick Scott signed gun control laws in the wake of mass shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and a nightclub in Orlando. He has consistently opposed weapons bans, arguing that many of his Republican colleagues, that most gun owners use them lawfully. Law enforcement officials have long called for stricter gun laws, arguing that the availability of these weapons makes people less safe and makes their jobs more dangerous. Mike Moore, chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, the country's third largest, said it just makes sense to talk about guns when gun violence is rising nationwide and consider what the government can do to make the streets safer. He is grateful Biden is bringing it up so much. This isn't a one-and-done, Moore said of the shooting in Colorado Springs. These things are evolving all the time in other cities. At any moment, another incident happens. It's crying out for the federal government, for our legislators, to go out and make this change. On Tuesday, six people were shot dead at a Walmart in Virginia. Over the past 6 months, there has been a supermarket shooting in Buffalo, New York, a massacre of school children in Uvalde, Texas, and the July 4th killing of revelers in Highland Park, Illinois. The legislation that Biden signed in June will, among other things, help states put in place red flag laws that make it easier for authorities to take weapons from people judged to be dangerous. But a ban was never on the table. A 60-vote threshold in the Senate means some Republicans must be on board. Most are steadfastly opposed, arguing it would be too complicated, especially as sales and varieties of the firearms have proliferated. There are many more types of these high-powered guns today than in 1994 when the ban was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. Biden was instrumental in helping secure the 1990s ban as a senator. The White House said that while it was in place, mass shootings declined, and when it expired in 2004, shootings tripled. The fact that the American people elected a president who has long been a vocal and steadfast supporter of bold gun safety laws, and recently re-elected a gun sense majority to the Senate, says everything you need to know about how dramatically the politics on this issue have shifted, said John Feinblatt, president of Every Town for Gun Safety. A few more stories here from around the nation, from around the world. Out of Beijing, Macau awards casino licenses. Macau has tentatively renewed the casino licenses of MGM Resorts, Las Vegas Sands, Wynn Resorts, and three Chinese rivals after they promised to help diversify its economy by investing in non-gambling attractions, the government said Saturday. The announcement is positive news for owners who invested billions of dollars to build the former Portuguese colony near Hong Kong into the biggest global gambling center. But the requirement to spend on theme parks, music, and sports adds to financial pressures at a time when revenue has plunged under anti-COVID-19 restrictions. Regulators will negotiate final terms before licenses take effect January 1st, the Office of Chief Executive Ho Yat-sang announced. A seventh bidder, newcomer Genting Group of Malaysia, received no license. Two children killed in Bronx stabbing. This is out of New York. Two small children died of stab wounds after their mother was taken into custody for observation Saturday night in New York City, police said. A 3-year-old boy and an 11-month-old boy were found in a Bronx apartment with multiple stab wounds to the neck and torso and did not survive after being transported to a hospital, police said. The 24-year-old mother of the children has been taken into custody and transported to a hospital less than an hour earlier after acting erratically at an address on Echo Place in Mount Hope. The mother was not arrested, and the children's father was not taken into custody, Deputy Chief Louis DeSegli of Patrol Borough Bronx said during a press briefing late Saturday. Police had a person of interest in custody, DeSegli said. These are briefs out of the White House. Musician John Batiste is on tap to perform at President Joe Biden's first White House state dinner on Thursday that will highlight long-standing ties between the United States and France and honor President Emmanuel Macron. A police officer fatally shot a man early Sunday while conducting a wellness check at a home in St. Petersburg, officials said. Detectives said Gus Spinoudis made suicidal statements and pointed a firearm at Officer Jace Morrow before being shot. Spinoudis, 63, was taken to a hospital and pronounced dead. A hotel attack. Somali security forces were attempting to flush out armed assailants from a hotel in the Somali capital of Mogadishu, a police spokesman said Sunday, after the extremist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. There was no immediate word of casualties. Out of New Mexico, three Albuquerque police officers were placed on administrative leave while an investigation continues into Friday's fatal officer-involved shooting of a knife-wielding man who was involved in a domestic dispute with his parents. Out of Mexico, hundreds of thousands of people marched in Mexico's capital Sunday in a show of support for President Manuel López Obrador, who led Sunday's march through central Mexico City. The People's March marked 4 years in office for the leftist leader and was a response to a large opposition march 2 weeks ago to protest López Obrador's proposal to reform the country's electoral authority. Iraq corruption. Iraq's government said on Sunday it will recover part of nearly $2.5 billion in funds embezzled from the country's tax authority in a massive scheme involving a network of businesses and officials. Those briefs were out of the Associated Press. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-7000. 6833. Okay, let's turn to the sports section. NCAA Women's Volleyball Tournament. USCD Women's Volleyball to play Houston. This is out of Vermilion, South Dakota. South Dakota found out its destination for the opening round of the NCAA Volleyball Tournament on Sunday. The Coyotes, the Summit League Tournament champions for the third straight year and fourth time in five seasons, are headed to the Creighton region, where they will face Houston in a first-round match on Friday afternoon at 3:30 p.m. at DJ Sokol Arena in the Wayne and Eileen Ryan Athletic Center, USD said in a statement. South Dakota, coming off a three-set sweep over Omaha in the Summit League title match, will take a 29-3 record into the opening round contest. Houston, a number 5 seed, has an overall record of 28-3 and went 19-1 in the American Athletic Conference. The Cougars tied with UCF atop the American Athletic Conference standings. This is the moment that every team works towards, and for us to be here right now and to see our name up on the TV is amazing, USD head coach Leanne Williamson said in a statement. We are excited for the draw, and we're excited to play somebody new. Williamson is in her ninth season as head coach of the Coyotes. She is the Summit League Coach of the Year for the third time in her career, and this year became the USD program's winningest coach. This will be the first meeting between South Dakota and Houston. Joining South Dakota and Houston in the regional is the number 4 seed and host Creighton, with a record of 27-4, and Auburn with a record of 21-8. NCAA women's basketball. UConn rallies past Iowa to win at Phil Knight. Hawkeye star Caitlin Clark had 25 points. This is from Eric Garcia Gunderson from the Associated Press out of Portland, Oregon. Ozzie Fudd scored 24 points to rally number 3 UConn past number 9 Iowa 86-79 Sunday in the championship game of the first Phil Knight Legacy Women's Tournament. It really was difficult to play against these guys, UConn coach Jean Orimia said. I don't think we felt really good about ourselves at halftime. I thought we came out in the third quarter and really took control of the game. Fudd had plenty of help with Ailea Edwards, 20 points and 13 rebounds, and three other Huskies, 5-0, scoring in double figures. Edwards was named MVP of the tournament. Iowa, whose record was 5-2, star Caitlin Clark had 25 points and Kate Martin added 20. Edwards got UConn off to a strong start, scoring 10 points, while the Huskies built a 20-14 edge. Clark and the Hawkeyes then surged with a 13-2 run to begin the second quarter and led 41-35 at halftime. Clark scored 17 points in the first half. Martin hit a three-pointer in the third quarter for a 52-41 lead, but UConn countered with 11 straight points and led 61-57 entering the fourth. Iowa opened the final quarter with 9 straight points for a 66-61 lead, but the Huskies countered and pulled away in the middle of the period, leading 79-70 after Carolina Ducharme's three-pointer with 3 minutes 42 seconds left. Ozzie Fudd really came to life in the third quarter, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. I was really pleased with our first half. If it wasn't for that third quarter, but yes, we play four, and we miss some shots in the fourth quarter that we usually make. The big picture, Iowa. Iowa dominated the battle of the three-point line for much of the game. The Hawkeyes made 13 three-pointers to only 8 for UConn. For UConn, Sunday was a tale of two halves for Fudd. Fudd started the game 1-for-8 from the field, but was red hot in the second half, going 9-for-11. Up next, the Hawkeyes will host North Carolina State on Thursday, and for UConn, the Huskies will host Providence on Friday. The Final Four, Hawkeyes and Horned Frogs. Four thoughts on Iowa basketball's Emerald Coast showing. This is by Steve Batterson. Four things to think about following the Iowa basketball team's runner-up finish at the Emerald Coast Classic. Number one, the bump and grind. The Hawkeyes played in a pair of physical games in the tournament, both in Friday's win over Clemson and Saturday's loss to TCU. Iowa met with mixed results, dealing with it against the Tigers, and never really adjusting to the physical challenges presented by a thicker Horned Frogs team on Saturday night. The experience should benefit Iowa in the long run. Both games were really physical, which is not unlike what we see in the Big Ten. I've got some veteran guys back, but this is a new team, and I think it's important to be able to play against teams that play with that level of physicality and figure it out, Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey said. We were good Friday night, but Saturday night, we weren't as good. We'll learn from it. Number two, the physical test. Forward Chris Murray was defended physically in both games and struggled to adjust. After knocking down 13 of 17 shots in a win over Omaha on Monday, Murray went 4 for 17 and 4 for 14 from the field in the two tournament games. The physical way Clemson and TCU defended him is something the junior will have to adjust to moving forward. Murray did finish with double-doubles in both games, totaling 11 points and 10 rebounds on Saturday. It was Murray's third straight double-double and the third time he has led Iowa on the boards. Number three, the three fall. Iowa's 3 3-point baskets against TCU were a season low. McCaffrey felt that allowed the Horned Frogs to create some separation that ultimately led to some quick shooting tendencies he said Iowa must avoid. Normally, we are a much better shooting team than that, McCaffrey said. We got it to the front of the rim a couple times, but it didn't fall for us. Number four, the board work. Iowa was beaten on the boards by the Horned Frogs 41-28, and TCU turned 13 offensive rebounds into 17 points. McCaffrey expects more as Iowa works towards Tuesday's 8 p.m. matchup against Georgia Tech in the ACC Big Ten Challenge at Carver Hawkeye Arena. They were cutting really well, and we were starting at the ball. Staring at the ball, he said. They got some layups. We wanted to keep them in front of us, so we have got to learn from that. Nebraska men's basketball. Huskers control interior in win over Florida. Derek Walker records his second consecutive double-double. This is by Jordan McAlpine, the Lincoln Journal Star. The Nebraska men's basketball team got back in the win column Sunday night with a 75-58 triumph over Florida State in Orlando. The Huskers finished the ESPN Events Invitational 1-2, and improve to 4-3 on the season. Derek Walker, playing in his second game of the season, recorded his second consecutive double-double. The Seminoles didn't have an answer for the 6'9" forward, who finished with 20 points and 13 rebounds. Walker made 4 of his 5 first-half shots and had a team-leading 6 rebounds at the half. He was clearly the best player on the court Sunday night. You see what he does for pressure, Fred Hoiberg said of Walker's performance on his post-game radio show. They were trying to get it out and deny, and you get the ball to Derek and he can go make a play and get to the rim. I thought he made some brilliant passes on some backdoor cuts as well. In a first half that featured 25 combined turnovers, 11 by the Huskers, Nebraska led 33-26 at the break. Nebraska finished the first half on a 12-2 run, including a 7-0 run in the final minutes. And the Huskers made 45.5%, 15 for 33, of their first half shots. Once we calmed down and started taking care of the ball, that was the big message at halftime. If we can take care of the ball, we're going to run away with this thing, Hoiberg said. Coming into Sunday's game, Florida State had struggled to take care of the ball and struggled in the paint. Nebraska attacked both, controlling the boards 21-13 in the first half and 38-34 overall. Nebraska also scored 50 of its 75 points in the paint. The Huskers, who were unable to overcome Memphis's pressure Friday, caused havoc on their own Sunday. The Seminoles turned the ball over 14 times in the first half, 5 more times in the second half. Just great activity all across the board, Hoiberg said of the team's defensive effort. I thought everybody was in the right spot for the most part. Walker, making his 50th career start at Nebraska, scored Nebraska's first bucket of the second half and set the tone of the final 20 minutes. The senior scored 12 of his 20 points in the second half and finished the night 10 for 12 from the field. Nebraska shot 50%, 33 for 66 as a team. The Huskers started to find their rhythm, and after struggling to make second-half shots against both Oklahoma and Memphis, their fortunes turned. Nebraska also turned the ball over just 3 times in the second half, which Hoiberg called the biggest stat of the game. When we got the ball down the floor and made good, solid, sound basketball plays, we got what we wanted, Hoiberg said. Nebraska's lead grew to 11, 43-32, on Sam Griesel's 4-point play 3 minutes and 15 seconds into the half. Then 14-48, 34, following another Griesel three-pointer. And U's lead climbed to 18 at 59-41, and the Huskers opened the second half on a 17-8 run. Griesel started the second half 3-for-3 from the field, 2-for-2 from behind the arc, and finished with 11 second-half points. After a hot start to the season, the North Dakota State transfer had cooled off over the past four games. However, Sunday was a step in the right direction, both for Griesel and the Huskers. He was one of three Huskers with 13 points, along with Kisai Taminga and C.J. Wilcher. Nebraska's lead got as high as 20, and besides FSU's 8-0 run with 8 minutes left, the Huskers cruised down the stretch to a 17-point win. Nebraska, whose record is 4-3, will return home and face Boston College Wednesday night at Pinnacle Bank Arena. Wednesday's game is part of the annual ACC-BIG Challenge and will tip off at 8:15 p.m. "It was a big win. We had to have it," Hoiberg said. "We've got a big one coming up here on Wednesday." Another basketball article. Phil Knight Invitational Tournament. Number 8, North Carolina, rallies to beat number 5, Iowa State. Out of Portland, Oregon, by Sean Hyken, the Associated Press. Deja Kelly scored 29 points to power number 8, North Carolina, to a 17-point comeback over number 5, Iowa State, and win 73-64 in the championship game of the Phil Knight Invitational Tournament Sunday. Kennedy Todd Williams added 17 points to help the Tar Heels, whose record is 6-0, complete the comeback and remain undefeated on the season. Alyssa Ustby contributed 14 points, 9 rebounds, 3 steals, and 2 blocks. "We're watching them become a team right in front of our very eyes," North Carolina head coach Courtney Banghart said. "Typically, that happens on the practice court. These guys are really becoming a team. We got better this weekend, and that was our goal." It was the third straight game that North Carolina trailed at the half before rallying to win. Stephanie Soares led the Cyclones, whose record is 5-1, with 19 points and 12 rebounds, while Ashley Jones had 18 points and 9 rebounds as Iowa State suffered its first loss of the year. "We're a team that has to make shots, and we didn't make many tonight," said Iowa State head coach Ben Fennelly. "A lot of work to do, but that's what this tournament's designed to do, find out what you're good at and find out what you're not so good at." Iowa State controlled the game throughout the opening two periods, taking a 35-22 lead into halftime, behind 12 first-half points and 9 rebounds from Soares. The Cyclones led by as much as 17 in the second quarter, but after halftime, the Tar Heels began to chip away at the deficit. A 15-0 fourth-quarter run gave North Carolina its first lead of the night, and they never gave it back to Iowa State. North Carolina got hot from three-point range in the second half and finished the game shooting 43.8%, 7 of 16, from deep. Iowa State dominated the glass, out-rebounding North Carolina 46-37. After North Carolina completed its comeback in the championship game, Kelly was named MVP of the tournament. Another article about Nebraska volleyball. NCAA tournament bracket. Nebraska volleyball selected number 2 seed, by Brent Wagner out of the Lincoln Journal-Star. Nebraska now knows a possible path if it's going to have another chance to play in a just-up-the-road Final Four in Omaha. In 2.5 weeks, Omaha puts on the Final Four for the fourth time, and that's been a good setup to the Husker program. Nebraska had made it to Omaha's Final Four 3 times, winning national championships there in 2006 and 2015, and reaching the semifinals in 2008. Omaha also hosted during the delayed 2020 season, when Nebraska lost against Texas in the Elite Eight and Kentucky won the title. Nebraska learned its NCAA tournament positioning during Sunday's selection show, with the Huskers earning one of the number 2 seeds. The Nebraska players watched the show together in its team lounge. In the first round, Nebraska will play Delaware State on Thursday at the Devaney Sports Center. The other first-round match, in Lincoln, is Miami, Kansas. The top 4 seeds are Texas, Louisville, Wisconsin, and Stanford. San Diego just missed top 4 overall seed. As expected, after Nebraska lost 3 of its last 5 matches of the regular season, Nebraska didn't earn one of the top 4 overall seeds, which had been a season-long goal. That means Nebraska will likely have to play on the road in Louisville, Kentucky, in the Sweet 16 and Elite 8, unless one of the higher-seeded teams loses in the first or second round. Louisville is coached by former Nebraska player and assistant coach Danny Busboom Kelly. But Nebraska avoided a region with Wisconsin, which has won 10 straight matches against the Huskers. In college volleyball, the top four seeds reached the Final Four a lot. Last year, three of the top four seeds, Louisville, Pittsburgh, and Wisconsin, reached the Final Four. The exception, of course, was Nebraska, which knocked off number one seed Texas in the Elite Eight in Austin, Texas. Nebraska finished with a 24-5 record and was second place in the Big Ten at 16-4. But Nebraska's Final Four hopes took a hit 5 days ago when defensive specialist Kenzie Knuckles suffered a season-ending knee injury during practice, and Nebraska lost its next two matches without her against Wisconsin and Minnesota. Setter Nicklin Hamas also wasn't able to play on Saturday due to illness, but should be ready to play when the tournament begins. Okay, let's turn to football. The Chicago Bears at New York Jets, 31-10. White's touchdown passes lead Jets past Bears. This is by Dennis Wasek Jr. from the Associated Press out of East Rutherford, New Jersey. Mike White was more than just all right for the New York Jets. He was absolutely terrific, delivering a performance that had the rain-drenched but fired-up fans at MetLife Stadium chanting his name throughout. White threw three touchdown passes, including two to Garrett Wilson in his first start since last season in place of a benched Zach Wilson, and the Jets rolled over the banged-up Chicago Bears 31-10 on Sunday. "It's awesome," White said. "I mean, just going out there playing football with your friends and guys you've been with for a couple years now." White sparked the Jets' 7-4 record to a season-high 466 yards in the rain, going 22 of 28 for 315 yards, while running the offense efficiently and effectively. White became the fifth player in NFL history to have multiple games with 300 yards passing and three touchdown passes in his first four career starts. He joined Patrick Mahomes, Austin Davis, Kurt Warner, and Mark Rypien to accomplish the feat. "He didn't need to be anybody but Mike White," Coach Robert Sala said. "He didn't need to turn it into the greatest show on turf. He made the easy look easy, and I thought he did a really good job with that." Elijah Moore, who requested a trade earlier this season because of a lack of opportunities, caught his first touchdown pass of the season. Ty Johnson had a 32-yard TD run for the Jets, who bounced back from a 10-3 loss at New England. Meanwhile, the Bears, with a record of 3-9, started Trevor Siemian at quarterback for an injured Justin Fields, and couldn't do much after their first two series. "Today was a complete team win," White said. "Our defense did what they always do, and they dominated." White already made it into the Pro Football Hall of Fame last year, when his jersey and game ball were displayed after his 37 completions in his debut were the most in NFL history in a player's first start. A fan favorite since that performance, White had to quiet the crowd that chanted, "Mike White," at times late in the game while the offense was on the field. "Nah, I'm not going to complain too much about that," he said with a smile. Added Garrett Wilson, "He got what he deserved. He deserved every bit of that." The only real intrigue for the Bears, who have lost five straight, was who would start at quarterback. Fields was ruled out 90 minutes before kickoff with an injured left shoulder. Trevor Siemian was slated to start in his place, but injured his oblique during warm-ups, and Chicago announced Nathan Peterman, elevated from the practice squad Saturday, would start instead. But both Siemian and Peterman threw on the sideline, and the Bears opted to go with Siemian after all. Siemian, who said the injury bothered him a bit, was 14 of 25 for 179 yards with a touchdown and an interception. "Honestly, I'm more embarrassed to get an injury," Siemian said. "You got guys in there in week 12 or 13 going through hell, and I had a non-contact thing show up." White marched the Jets downfield and capped the opening drive with an 8-yard touchdown pass to Garrett Wilson to give New York an early 7-0 lead. It was the Jets' first touchdown this season on an opening drive. After Cairo Santos' 22-yard field goal cut the deficit to 7-3, Siemian threw a 4-yard touchdown pass to Byron Pringle. But that was it for Chicago on offense. "The second half wasn't good enough for either side of the ball," Coach Matt Eberflus said. There's no excuses, no explanation. It just wasn't good enough. After holder Brandon Mann fumbled the snap on Greg Zuerlein's potential tying 36-yard field goal, White and the offense got back into the end zone when Wilson spun and juked Kendall Vildor before racing for a 54-yard touchdown that put New York up 14-10. With 12 seconds left before halftime, and Mann wearing gloves this time, Zuerlein booted a 57-yarder through the rain, the longest field goal at home in franchise history, tying the overall mark for any game he already shared with Chandler Catanzaro. Moore's 22-yard touchdown catch and Johnson's tackle shedding 32-yard scoring run made it 31-10 late in the third quarter. C.J. Mosley's interception of Simeon with 5:04 left sealed it for the Jets, who snapped a 5-game skid against the Bears. Revis honored. The Jets inducted former cornerback Darrell Revis into the team's Ring of Honor at halftime. Revis, a semifinalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame in his first year of eligibility, was one of the NFL's top shutdown cornerbacks in his prime. Revis played for the Jets from 2007 to 2012 and 2015 to 2016. Injuries for the Bear. Wide receiver Darnell Mooney left in the third quarter with an ankle injury. Eddie Jackson injured a foot in the second and didn't return. And Riley Reiff's shoulder left in the first and was replaced by Larry Borum, who also was injured late. Dane Cruikshank injured a hamstring. For the Jets, running back Michael Carter injured his ankle, Ashton Davis his hamstring, Chaz Surratt and Cedric Ogbui groin injuries, all left with injuries. Up next, the Bears host Aaron Rodgers and the NFC North rival Green Bay Packers next Sunday, and the Jets head to Minnesota to take on the Vikings next Sunday. The World Cup first round. Kramaric powers Croatia. Stars' 2 goals lead 4-1 victory to oust Canada. This is out of the Associated Press and out of Qatar. Croatia bounced back strong and knocked Canada right out of its first World Cup in 36 years. The 2018 runners-up got 2 goals from Andrej Kramaric on Sunday in a 4-1 victory over a Canadian team that has been eliminated after 2 matches in Qatar. Alphonso Davies scored Canada's first-ever World Cup goal 1 minute into the match, but Marco Levaja and Lavro Major also scored for Croatia, which lost to France in the final 4 years ago in Russia, and opened with a scoreless draw against Morocco. Luka Modric, the 37-year-old captain who runs the midfield for Croatia, is still looking for his first goal of the tournament in what is likely his final World Cup. Croatia and Morocco, which caused another upset at this year's tournament by beating Belgium 2-0 earlier Sunday, both have 4 points in Group F. Belgium has 3 points and still has a chance to advance. Canada, however, earned no points from its first 2 matches and can't advance even if it beats Morocco on Thursday in its final match. Croatia and Belgium will play at the same time. Canada opened the tournament with a 1-0 loss to Belgium. Afterward, coach John Herdman stirred a bit of controversy when he recounted his post-game message to his players using the first letter of a profanity to describe how they would beat Croatia. Germany won, Spain won. Germany forward Niklas Füllkrug salvaged a draw against Spain. The Germans still need to win their last group match to have a chance of advancing to the knockout stage. The 4-time champions were eliminated in the group stage 4 years ago in Russia. Germany will face Costa Rica next, but a win may not be enough for the Germans, who are in last place in Group E and need the other result to go their way. Morocco 2, Belgium 0. Morocco pulled off another shock at the World Cup on Sunday, beating Belgium 2-0 to leave Kevin De Bruyne and the 2018 semifinalists in peril of a group stage exit. Substitute Abdelhamid Sabiri got one past Belgium goalkeeper Thibaut Courtois by whipping in a free kick from a tight angle at the near post in the 73rd minute for Morocco's first goal. Zakaria Aboukal then guided a shot into the roof of the net off a pass from Hakim Ziyech in stoppage time. Costa Rica 1, Japan 0. Kaiser Fuller scored in the 81st minute to lift Costa Rica over Japan, leaving both teams with 3 points after two games in Group E of the World Cup. Fuller took advantage of a defensive error when Japan failed to clear the ball. His shot from 18 meters grazed off the fingertips of Japan goalkeeper Shuichi Gonda, finding the back of the net. U.S. England gets 19.98 million viewers out of New York. The United States 0-0 draw against England in the World Cup drew 19.98 million viewers for English and Spanish language broadcasts, the third most watched men's soccer game on U.S. television. The match, which kicked off at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Friday, was seen by 15,377,000 viewers on Fox, the most for a U.S. English language men's soccer telecast. The figure was 6% above the 14.51 million for Brazil's penalty kicks win over Italy in the 1994 final at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, a Sunday 3:30 p.m. EDT start that July 17 viewed by 14,510,000 on ABC, according to Fox. The U.S.-England game was viewed by 4.6 million on Telemundo, a division of Comcast Core's NBC Universal. It was the third most watched Spanish language World Cup telecast in the U.S. since at least 2006, topped by the United States' 2-2 group stage draw with Portugal in 2014, seen by 6.5 million on Univision, with a 6 p.m. EDT start in mid-June, and Brazil's 2-0 win over Serbia on Thursday, a 2 p.m. EDT game seen by 5.7 million on Thanksgiving. Brussels riots after cup loss. Out of Brussels, police had to seal off parts of the center of Brussels, deploy water cannons, and fire tear gas to disperse crowds following violence during and after Morocco's 2-0 upset win over Belgium at the World Cup. Dozens of rioters overturned and torched a car, set electric scooters on fire, and pelted cars with bricks. Police moved in after one person suffered facial injuries, said Brussels police spokesman Eels van de Keer. That was from the Associated Press. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm Teresa Whitaker, your reader today. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.